Welcome to The Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You could follow us on Facebook at the search bar. You go to The Matthew Aaron Show and you click like and you'll get all our updates. You can leave your comments and such. We're going to go right into things today. Last night I went to see the premiere of Insidious Chapter 2, which I got to tell you is a lot of fun. And we were talking, I was just talking to Lynn Shays joining us and Lee Wanell, right?
That's correct.
Did I get it right?
Yes, you did.
See?
One of four people in my whole life.
Lynn taught me, so that's cheating.
Yeah.
I asked her. I go teach me.
A full-blown lesson.
I knew you were pretentious, though. You got the little, like, French thing going on in your Australian name.
French?
Wanell.
Well, it's actually Scottish.
About
as un-French as you can get.
Yeah, Scottish. Still terrible.
Not American. That's what I mean.
Let me tell you something.
Got that American accent.
Well, we're going to tell this story of how I met you last night, because that's kind of funny. But he's wearing a Billy Joel shirt, and everyone that listens to this show knows I'm like the biggest Billy Joel fan. I saw him in a private concert, 200 people, a couple months ago at
what
the Roxy.
What do you mean private?
It was just for, like, invite
just
only.
You and him?
It was me, him. Helen Mirren was there, like
yeah.
People like that. Taylor Hackford.
Well, she likes to watch.
I must have snuck in.
Yeah, like, cool. I love that. You're like. I love that he's
the
trying to show off how cool it was. And it was
me.
Like Helen Mirren was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's right.
Tom Wilkinson.
No, Tom Wilkinson.
Judi Dench was there.
I wish.
Ian McKellen.
I wish. No,
yeah.
I think Sandler was there, but people like that. And then Mike Binder like snuck me in. He's like, can Maddie come in? And they're like, yeah, whatever. And he played like 3 hours. He told stories about all the times he was taking requests. It was the most amazing thing ever.
It's a funny thing about L.A. is that because all these industry people live here, you always get these weird private events.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, stuff happens that the public can go to. They have concerts and all that. But then you'll hear from a friend like, oh, I'm so hungover. Last night, Prince.
Yeah, right.
Played at a bar mitzvah in Bel Air, and it was amazing. They had giraffes running across the stage. There's always these private events that are sponsored. It's usually like Guess Jeans presents, you know, Phoenix.
And we don't get invited to
and
these
we don't,
things.
And we, you, these things happen. They exist.
I know. And the people that tell you these stories, you're like, you're not that much better than me. How'd you get invited?
Yeah, I know.
Who
What's
do
the
you
swearing
know?
Policy on this show?
Anything you want.
Anything you want.
Lynn, have you ever been to any like crazy parties out here? What's like the craziest party you've been to out here?
Out here.
Like the weirdest thing happened. Like someone performed. Like Sandler last year had like at his Christmas party he had Marilyn Manson and who do I love that was there?
Jackson Brown.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Marilyn Manson and Jackson Brown. Great duets there. that's a duet album waiting to happen. But like. That kind of stuff happens. What about you? You've been in huge movies, so you
I
had
know,
to been to like
I,
some
I
crazy party.
I haven't been to that many crazy parties. I have to go to Lee's house to find some.
Oh, really? You have crazy parties?
I actually have a few crazy parties at my house.
I'm going to have to stay friends with
Lee. They had like a detective birthday, which was phenomenal.
Really?
That's right. So my wife organized for my 35th birthday, she organized, it was like a scavenger hunt slash detective game. Now, but she didn't hire some company to do it. And her brother, they went around Hollywood.
All over the city? The whole
voraciously
city or just
breaking the law.
Yeah,
and
right.
Putting up graffiti and signs. And it was amazingly complex. Like, let me just give you one clue. The first clue, it was, we live in Los Feliz, kind of near Griffith Park, and it was something to do with the bear. You know, there's a statue of a bear there in Griffith Park.
Yes.
So we go there. Hi there for all you non-LA listeners who are like,
there's a bear
statue in Griffith Park, whatever. So we turn up there, and posted on the bear is a picture of the front cover of Slaughterhouse-Five.
Okay.
So what would you think based on that? We're in Los Feliz, Slaughterhouse-Five. Anything come to mind? You might be one of these geniuses who goes, well, of course.
Well, was anything done in Los Angeles that was related to Slaughterhouse-Five?
Well, there was. What was the major event in Slaughterhouse-Five? There was an event from World War II that was major. It was the bombing of...
What would it be in Los Angeles? Bombing of what?
The bombing of Dresden.
Dresden, okay.
Oh, my God.
So it sends you to, like, Dresden Street?
Dresden Room, the bar in Los Feliz.
Oh, okay, the room, okay.
So we
really,
crazy. But wait, we didn't know we were right. We just had a hunch. We were like, hang on, the Dresden Room, let's go.
Yeah.
We drive over there, we park at the Dresden Room, we walk in. I look around, the bar's normally operating. It's full of people. I walk up to the bartender. I'm like, I know this is going to sound crazy, but is there some clue or something that we're supposed to
ask you about?
The bartender just winks at me and goes, reaches under the bar and gives me a copy of Slaughterhouse 5. Inside the inside cover is a phone number. And so I call the number on my phone. That's how intricate this game was. I could go on for another hour.
What was
that's
the next clue?
I'm married Corbett. Is
yeah, I know, exactly. This detective game won
find,
me over.
But you can find her when you're looking for her.
It went on for a long time, but you actually got me thinking about when you said, what's the craziest thing you've ever been to? My memory is serving me badly because I'm so hungover. But
yeah.
I feel like there has to be some crazy private party that we went to. You know, the band Maroon 5,
yeah, okay.
They throw a Halloween party every year at the Hollywood Cemetery.
Okay.
Which is, it's not so much a weird event, but you go there and the amount of money that's been spent on it is insane. I mean, they have a full circus set up with like carousels and rides and sideshows.
That's pretty great.
It's insane. And that's definitely something, but I'm trying to think of...
I actually just thought of something.
You got one?
Let's do it. When I first came here... I was staying at the Chateau Marmont because I didn't know where to go, and a friend of mine said, "Well, here, why don't you stay there for a few
just a
nights?
Cheap hotel,
yeah, right. just a cheap little
just a motel
dive
on the strip." and there was this really odd. I got a phone call by mistake. It was like someone called my room. No, this is really weird. And it was Roman Polanski. This is no joke.
It wasn't by mistake. No, how old were you at the time?
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
She was eight.
She was eight.
Now.
Sorry, Roman.
But it was this, the woman that I was, you know, that had told me about staying at the hotel, he was having a cocktail party.
Where at?
At the Chateau.
But so he accidentally called your room.
Yes, because I...
Can you do your impression of Roman Polanski?
No, I can't. I'm not that good
of an
actor.
What did he say when he called you?
He just said, he asked me if this was room blah, blah, blah. And I said, I can't remember the room number. And I said, yes. He said, I just wanted to let you know about the party in my bungalow this evening.
In my pants. Too easy.
I can't remember the exact details, but we ended up going. I went with this other woman. We ended up going to this party where there were a lot of people, and it was this very surreal.
At his bungalow, or you went somewhere else?
It was at the Chateau.
How many people can you fit in the
bungalow?
There
must have been like about 20 people, and everybody was waiting for him to show up. Seriously. And I remember there was this knock
on
the door.
So he rents a bungalow, makes people go there to wait for him to
show
up at the place.
And I remember, but this was like, I really did. I felt like I was in a movie. There was a knock on the door, and you know, they have those little grates where you open it.
Yeah,
like the little side.
And there was this person, and it was him, like at the grate, and they opened the door.
He was standing on like a box or something.
He came in, he was with this young woman, and her mother was actually at the hotel with us. And she, it was, there was some kind of dialogue, and he kind of came through the party, was jumping on like chairs and playing like antics, kind of like real antics.
Was this before or after Roman's problems?
This was obviously before.
He was still in this country.
He hasn't been back since.
Well, it could have been during the time period because he did get arrested once and then he fled. And there was like a year-long period he was still here.
You know, I mean, I've always been such a fan of his.
I know. I think he's a great director.
He's one of the all-time great directors. But this was just, it was this odd, honest to God, sort of almost out-of-body experience. And no, wait, there's more to it.
Yeah.
Because he left with this girl and the mother. He left with the two women, as far as I remember. And then everybody kind of looked around.
Yes.
But nobody knew what to do, so everybody just kind of dispersed. And I remember I went out to dinner, and we were eating an antipasto, and I took two big cloves of garlic by mistake in my mouth, and I thought, well, it's a good thing I just had that garlic. And there was, I swear to you, this is the truth. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, my phone rang, and it was him. And he said, "Is this Linda?" And my name is really Linda. That's my name. And I said, "Yes." And I was so staggered. I was so, like, frightened. I literally hung up the phone. I locked all the doors. I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I had, and to this day, I don't really know. I can't.
Hasn't contacted you,
son. No, but this was the most bizarre
so
thing
weird.
Almost that's ever happened
that
in Los Angeles.
That is a great story. A Polanski story is pretty.
The
that outdoes
you can't
the
really
five.
Beat that.
No,
you can't really beat that.
And I don't know who the girl was. I don't know who the mother was. Yeah. And I didn't even know who any of the other people were. But he sort of gathered
because that's
people.
So weird. Because the and I'm just speculating, and it's a total assumption. But the girl who he got in trouble with, he had a close relationship with the mother, too. That's how he got the girl to come over to pose for his magazine photo.
Whatever. Anyway, yep. I had no real conversation. But when my phone rang in the middle of the night, I honestly, I thought I was
truly
dreaming.
Could have been the best decision you ever made.
That was
I don't think he would have. I was too old for him to begin with. He's awesome. I mean,
he's great.
I hope.
I had an early
movies.
Thing. I actually wrote a bit about it on my blog. So maybe I won't tell the long version.
I like your blog, by the way. The big dragons, like right on top.
Yeah, the wordinthestone.com. The sword in the stone without the S. But
you had a great thing about the Great Mouse Detective.
I actually wrote a little bit about early on when I first got to LA. I ended up. I didn't know anyone, so I kind of crashed a double date. I knew this one guy in L.A.
Yeah.
It was like going to Iceland and calling
famous
the one...
Famous guy, not famous
no,
guy?
No, not famous. I knew... I just had met him in London, and I was like, hi, I'm the guy that you know. You're the one guy that I know in L.A. And I felt like Sandy in Greece, because I thought we had shared this great time in London, and he was like... I was like...
Who?
Yeah, he's like, who is it again? Lee? And I'm like, what about London?
Yeah, right.
So I said, what are you doing tonight? Fine, I'm coming, before he had a chance to answer. And I ended up crashing this double date. Two guys turn up, two girls, and there I am on the end. And one of the girls was Alicia Silverstone. I believe it's pronounced Alicia.
Alicia.
So sure enough, to give you the short version, I ended up getting so drunk that I was sitting in the back of her car, and I ninja vomited all over the floor. And when I say ninja vomited, I mean it was like...
Like put your head in your lap and then just like let go
what? This wasn't a movie vomit where you're like...
Yeah, right. It's not Farrelly Brothers vomit. No.
Not even the guy next to me knew it had happened. Now, I mean, there's a visual component, but for the listeners, it was like this. It was like... But the speed and sound of the vomit did not match the content because... It looked like a bucket of shark chunk.
Oh,
God. Thank you, Lee.
Oh. I then, you know what my plan was? I was like, okay, I've just vomited in Alicia Silverstone's BMW. What do I do now? And she pulled up at a gas station, and I said, I'm just going to go and buy some gum, and ran off. That was my plan. I ran out of there.
Have you seen her since?
I have not.
No, I've probably for
listening.
A good reason.
Between the blog and this, you must have heard this
story.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to get a dry cleaning bill in the mail. But
for a BMW.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it like on the floor to land on stuff? Because some people...
It kind of landed all over my feet. I think my shoes were a little crusty. They had that residue.
All right, enough.
But I mean, it's funny this topic because...
Enough already, Lee.
You know, I think that there are things... That can only happen to you in LA. It's such a because it is this entertainment hub that have all these random people. It is the only city where you could have Roman Polanski call at
3 o'clock
this
in the morning.
This weird
by
random
mistake.
Stuff. It just happens. Like we're sitting recording this podcast in a restaurant that's owned by Joe Montagna.
Yeah, that's right.
Like it's just kind of a funny. I mean, have you had a lot of these things where all of a sudden you're getting stoned
even,
at like
even last night was
Eric
weird
Stoltz's
to me.
House at 3 a.m.
Things have happened.
Have you
that
ran
are
into
really
Lee Winnell in a parking lot.
Right. Well, here's what's really odd for me is like last night even I'm with my friend Nadia, and by the way, speaking of vomit, like the movie was so scary, she's like, I think I'm going to fill up this popcorn bag with vomit.
Oh my God.
That's what she said to me in the middle of the movie. I look at her, I'm like, please don't puke.
That needs to go on a poster.
Yeah, right. But I'm taking a VIP private tour of the haunted house on the Universal lot with Patrick Wilson.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can't get that anywhere else.
Yeah.
Like, it's me. Patrick Wilson sits at the table where your character sits. Right. Like, he literally sat down there, and he's, like, being all weird and doing the acting stuff. And I'm like, this only happens in L.A. It's funny stuff.
Yep. It is amazing that people, your friends, as you said, they don't even have to necessarily be connected, for want of a better word, in the industry. But they'll come to you and say, man, I had the weirdest weekend. I ended up at the guy who plays Malcolm's dad in Malcolm in the Middle. You know, that was Brian Cranston, actually.
Right.
You know, I ended up at, like, some party in the valley, and it was the guy from Pulp Fiction, Zed. It was his house, and I mean, this stuff is so strange, and I feel like someone should put out a book of weird LA party stories.
They do have books, but they don't write them anymore. Like from the 80s and 90s, Biskind had some books, Peter Biskind,
well,
and
that Don Simpson book was crazy.
Central.
I mean, there was so much going on.
But no one writes about it anymore because I think everyone's afraid that they're like going to piss someone off and not get work. I think all the people that could write about it want
to
get work in the future.
Well, Lynn's brother ran New Line in its heyday. You must have some stories from the Freddy Krueger years. Did you get stoned with Robert Englund or something?
I really didn't.
You must have.
I am such a square with all that. I mean, really, except for
really?
If Robert Polanski hadn't called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd have nothing to talk
about.
That's
pretty
funny.
You know, speaking of Polanski and about Insidious real quick, listen, you're a great horror writer.
Thank you.
And James, of course, Lynn and I were talking before the show started. I think he's the best horror director right now, period.
I think he is, absolutely.
Hands down.
The consensus seems to be as well.
So, Roman Polanski, who influenced you when you write horror? Because you're a funny guy, too. You can do comedy. You can do all kinds of things. So who influenced you as a horror writer?
Stephen King, obviously, is a huge influence. Growing up, I just plowed through all his books. As a horror writer, I think he's really the master. It's really hard to scare people with the written word.
Yeah.
I mean, a screenplay is one thing because a screenplay is like the blueprints for a house that hasn't been built yet.
Sure.
But what I was amazed with when it came to Stephen King is that he doesn't need visuals, he doesn't need a soundtrack, he doesn't need orchestral stings, just the power of his words. So I've always been impressed with him. But I think the films that have influenced me the most, it wouldn't so much be horror filmmakers as select films that I continually return to, like The Shining.
Yeah.
Which I saw the other night again. It's actually been on.
It's genius.
It's great, right?
Film.
Is it better than the book? Because you know Stephen King hated it.
I know that's an interesting thing.
What's interesting?
I never read that book. Did you?
I did read it.
Yeah.
And I love the movie. I really like the book too. But I actually think the movie went to this other place.
I agree.
It just went to this whole other level. And I think Stephen King has come around over the
years.
He's softened. I just think that it must be hard when you have that much ownership of something, and it's so personal. You know, the book was about this
guy
who's struggling.
Maximum Overdrive.
Yes, I know.
Probably
exactly.
Calm down a little on The Shining and Stanley Kubrick. You know,
he's like, I'll show you. You know, soda machines that fight back.
Right.
Take that, Kubrick.
I just always wanted to sit down with Stephen King and be like, you hate The Shining, but Cujo's good. let's call a spade a spade here.
That's
pretty
a great
good.
Point.
Pretty good.
Cujo is one of those films that you thought was a masterpiece when you were 11.
I know. I was
and
just talking about last week.
You reinvestigate it, and you're like, oh, ouch.
Yeah, no, it's no good now, but it was, like, the greatest thing ever at 11. Christine, too. Like, when you're, like, 13, you're like, this is the coolest movie ever. And then now you watch it today, and you're like, yeah.
Well, you know, he has this insane deal, Stephen King. Now, I hope I'm not misquoting this, but you can get the rights to one of his stories for
really?
$1.
For $1?
That's all he charges.
Well,
$1. That he gets to pick.
Jason is doing a film that's based on a Stephen King
is
story.
Is
yeah,
it?
Jason
Blum,
who
did Insidious and Paranormal Activity and Stretch.
I'm pretty certain that this is called Misery now, I think. And
is it a remake to Misery?
Well, no.
Oh,
I know what you're thinking
Mercy.
Oh,
I'm
Mercy.
Sorry, not
okay.
Misery.
Misery was that great one that Rob Reiner
was great.
Now, I'm not sure if this dollar deal only applies to student filmmakers. Like, if you write a letter to him, I don't know if The Shawshank Redemption, surely they didn't buy the rights to that.
$1.
But one thing I do know about him is if you're a student filmmaker and you want to adapt one of his stories, if you write to him and make a good case, he'll charge you $1, and you have to send him $1, and you can make...
You can
a lot of student films I've seen have been based on Stephen King stories.
Right.
He'll give out the rights.
I'm going to lie and say I'm a student.
I think that's completely...
It's great. It's really classic.
He's giving people the opportunity to say, hey, if you can convince me
that
you can visualize
your
book better than me, go for it.
So
you know?
I wanted to tell the people listening how I met Lee last night. First of all, I was telling Lynn when she arrived that I was too nervous. I told you this yesterday, too.
Yeah.
I was too nervous to talk to you. Like, I was bugging the shit out of Pat Wilson. Like, I don't care, whatever.
Except
I'm annoying.
When you heard you call him Pat.
Yeah, right.
Probably was
right.
Not real thrilled.
No. That's what I do for everybody. Everybody gets, like, the shortened name because I'm too lazy. Patrick sounds so pretentious. Calm down. I know. You're an actor.
French sounding.
Jim Wan. Are you going to call him?
Jimmy Wan.
Jimmy
Wan.
Jimmy Wan.
Jimmy Wan. I'm going to throw an S on it. Jimmy Wan. Johnny Stamos. I call him Johnny Stames.
Right.
Johnny Stames. Bobby Sags. Bob Saget. Yeah, I got all the nicknames. Davy Cools for Dave Coulier.
So, but exclusively only nicknaming the people on Full House.
That's it. That's it. Candy
what are the What are the tweens
Candy
called?
Cams. Yeah, but last
There's
night.
There's Meerkats. That's Mary Kate.
Yeah, Mary. Yeah,
Meerkats and
Meerkats. I like
Meerkats.
Meerkats.
But
you're good.
A writer.
I just like that he's confining his nicknames to the cast of Full House.
Yeah,
that's really his milieu. That's where he feels most comfortable. Is
where
in a room
I spend
full
my
of
childhood. Full House and Family Matters.
So let's go to this story. So you watched the movie.
So I was way too nervous to talk to Lynn because I grew up idolizing the Farrelly Brothers and like everything
very
you've
hot
ever
shoes.
Been.
It was the shoes.
You look good. Yeah. You look good today, yeah. too. You look really good.
Thank you.
So,
I look like Nick Nolte's mugshot for the listeners.
Except a little more hungover.
No, you should see his hair.
He did look a bit fresh.
His chest hair is sort of hanging out of his shirt. He's got. He didn't do his ears this morning, so they're a little, never mind.
Caesar looked it up. The $1 King things for available to nonprofit filmmakers.
So
if
you're a
nonprofit not
make
a
filmmaker,
profit, write them and give
you
them
get
some.
Get a movie made.
But you know that's a great way to make a short or something to prove that you could be a for-profit filmmaker.
Yes.
So take advantage.
Absolutely.
Of that. So I want to know if Lee remembers this story the way I remember it. This is what happened last night because he was a little drunk, so he may remember it differently. So first of all, I get to this after party because my date was really late, so we missed the whole red carpet thing. I only saw Patrick Wilson on the red carpet and I think Rose Byrne for like a minute. So like I was at Yogurtland waiting and like eating. And I'm like, all right, Yogurtland's better than this. And then so I go to the premiere. Movie's fun. It's a good time. And we're going to talk about that, too, because I was talking to Lynn about how it's really a two-parter. But it's a three-hour movie, like cut into two movies.
Right.
So anyways, go to this after party, and first I see you, and I don't talk to you at this point. And I go, who the fuck's that agent? Look at that suit on that motherfucker. That suit on that motherfucker.
Yeah.
He thinks he's something hot. Because every
so French.
Every premiere we go to,
the worst.
The agents are usually wearing suits. The producers are usually wearing, like, a suit jacket, but they got, like, on, like,
jeans on.
Yeah, dressy jeans
a Marvel
or
T-shirt
something.
Underneath the jacket.
Like, I literally have it, like, knocked down to a science. I could tell you which agents are gay. I could tell you, like, and I just point them out. Because as you saw me, Lee finally saw me and came over because he wanted to smoke. I just sit in a corner at these things and, like, judge people. I just, like, point to people and go, agent,
you
agent,
did look very judgy,
agent.
But you were the only person that was smoking. That's the thing is nobody smokes at these L.A. parties.
I'm the guy in high school at the high school parties that goes to the corner, smokes, and like...
Oh, we beelined. I was with a friend of mine from Australia, and we just looked over. It was like Terminator vision.
Yeah.
You know, like, doot, 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 match, bang, beeline, walk over. Lowest form of human life, by the way. The person who's asking for a cigarette.
I was wearing a red Japanese shirt. Like, I totally didn't look like I should go to a premiere.
You're like, here comes this French motherfucker.
Yeah, right.
What is
That's what I was thinking, you French asshole.
So, slacks
for everyone, though, that watches you, they would probably think Lee is American if they didn't know a lot about you because you've done a lot of American films and you do an American accent.
Yeah,
flawlessly. So, well, because I would have never guessed in a million years, really. So he comes over and him and his friend ask for a cigarette, and I didn't know who he was. So I just started, like, busting his fucking chops because I do it to everybody.
Yeah.
I go, oh, you want a fucking cigarette? Well, you don't bring your own anywhere. Like, I'm really just, like, busting on him. And then I'm like, let me guess. You need a light, too, right? I'm just, like, hammering. And I go, what do you do? And he goes, and he's, like, really humble. And I can tell he doesn't want to talk about what he does. And he's like, actually, I wrote the movie. And I'm like, oh, you're coming on my show tomorrow. That's great.
And that's why I'm here to say, fuck you. Right now, on the air, go fuck yourself with your cigarette. What does that cost? 2 cents?
I'm like, no,
Jesus,
25
you piece of
something.
Shit, you French motherfucker. That's the type of thing they want to give out cigarettes.
And then we ended up talking about, like, Dragon Slayer.
I wanted to exclusively talk on the show about 80s sword and sorcery films.
And I'm fine
genre
with
that happened.
I'm fine with that John Borman flick. Sure, let's do it.
You know, you would rent those videos based on the cover art. They'd always be those Frank Frazetta ripoffs.
I know.
It would always be a man holding a sword
videos.
With like two wenches grabbing at his ankles. And
Deathstalker.
Deathstalker.
Like
Deathstalker had a great poster.
Too. They both had great posters.
Amazing
Green
poster.
Had great posters.
Actually, Dragon Slayer's poster wasn't that.
It was kind of lame, but it was the coolest, like, creature ever in film.
Yes.
I still argue I think it's cooler than anything, including Jaws.
Actually, Guillermo del Toro, I read a quote from him recently saying the dragon in Dragon Slayer is his favorite
dragon film ever. It's like the coolest thing
ever. It is amazing.
Yeah.
Conan the Barbarian. Lynn's like, when do I get to talk?
No,
Lynn loves Deathstalker. She's like, let's talk more about Deathstalker.
Were you in any 80s sword and sorcery films?
No.
No.
You never got the
call? I have the most boring interview today.
No, you're not. No.
Not at all.
No.
Listen, we want to hear about the Farrelly brothers.
I don't have very I'm not a party girl. And I
have you seen any
dragons.
80s sword and sorcery movies?
Well, actually, my son is a huge fan of all of those, of the books and of all the...
So you had to, like, sit around and watch them when he was growing up?
I mean, if you come to my house, you'll see there's bookshelves of the
You're the really... You know how on iTunes they have the introductory tracks, and then it's, like, deep cuts?
Yeah,
if you really want to get deep cuts, you'd go to, like, Beastmaster.
Yeah, Beastmaster.
The Sword and the Sorcerer.
Yep.
I was with, you know, the Anderson Fairy Tales.
Yeah, right. That's where I lost you.
I grew up in, like, my favorite cartoon ever was Sword in the Stone. Like, I thought it was, like, the coolest
thing
ever.
Yeah, that is so underrated.
And the other reason I knew I loved you, other than the Billy Joel shirt, is when I went to your blog, I'm like, great fucking Mouse Detective. It's, like, the greatest movie ever.
It's awesome.
Sword in the Stone and Great Mouse Detective. Disney's two most underrated films.
And the Black Cauldron.
You
know, don't forget
Adam
Black Cauldron.
Didn't Adam Rifkin write the Mouse Detective?
Did Rifkin do it?
Yeah, I think
Rifkin's great. Rifkin's great. What's that crazy movie he did in the
80s? The Dark Backwood.
Yeah,
the Dark Backwood. The comedian with the eyes.
And he also did The Night of the Golden Eagle.
That's crazy, yep.
Which is a spectacular.
I've not seen that.
He was supposed to come with me last night, actually.
Oh, Rifkin's great.
Rifkin?
Yeah.
Peter Schenk is his...
Shut the bed on Rifkin.
The Mouse Detective was his. I think he wrote that.
The Mouse Detective's great. I wish they would remake Black Cauldron, too, because I think that could be a really cool movie. It was too dark for Disney.
I know. Well, Disney went through that weird period, like, where they didn't quite know who they were. It's before they rediscovered themselves with, like, Aladdin and the Lion King.
That's right.
This weird period of, like, Great Mouse Detective and Black Hole.
Yeah.
I think Black Hole was their first movie that wasn't G-rated.
That's right.
PG. But it was really... I find the Disney movies from that period so fascinating before they sort of discovered
themselves. Was Black Cauldron PG, too?
You may be right. We might have to get our man on the laptop here on that. I just want to hear, not to segue too much, but we are sort of jumping around, but surely, Lynn, you've got some Bill Murray stories.
Oh.
Well, see, that was another thing, that I didn't ever meet him.
Never got to meet
him.
You never met Murray?
He
didn't go to the premiere at Kingpin?
But he didn't go. I don't think he went.
He is so...
He was...
I've even met Bill Murray.
I can tell you about Woody Harrelson, who was...
Woody's the best,
Woody
right?
was the best. I mean, I was so scared to meet
How
him.
How high did you get with him?
Not at all.
I'm
so square.
Not even like a secondhand high?
No, I don't think. I mean,
then why are you smoking a joint right now?
Because
if you're such a square, what's with the garter belt and the fishnets?
Because we're here at 603 North Hollywood Way,
Taste
Chicago in Burbank. We're smoking bongs.
That's my best bong sound effect. Ready?
That's pretty good.
Why am I doing the lighter action?
Yeah.
No one can
like
see
people
this.
People are watching you.
I'm not wearing pants right now.
Your method.
My jeans just tore, and literally my balls are about
to hang out.
On air. On the air. This is happening live.
So you got to have a good Woody story.
Woody was just... I mean, he was the most accessible person when I met him. I was scared to death because I had never really worked with anybody of his stature before. This is when I did Kingpin.
Yeah.
And
by the way, Black Cauldron was PG. It was the first animated Disney film to be PG.
Wow.
So I was correct. Yes. Continue.
But anyway, and I had all these ideas about this character, which I actually went to the audition. I think you know the story maybe or maybe not.
No, I don't know.
I had done a little tiny part in Dumb and Dumber.
Yes.
Playing Mrs. Nugaberger.
Yes, you were
Jeff
the Dad dogs.
The dogs.
They
right?
delivered
the, dog
the dogs to you, yeah.
And I found out that they were making this other movie called Kingpin, and I called the office. I was being very proactive, and the receptionist said, oh, yeah, you had that little role in Dumb and Dumber. I'll send you the script. And Mrs. Dumars is described as the angriest, ugliest woman God ever let loose on the planet. I'll never forget that description as long as I live. And I thought, I got to do this. And I started working on the character and writing notes to people asking for an audition. And Rick Montgomery, who's an awesome casting director, said, we love your work, Lynn, but no, we really don't think you're right for this. And I just kept, I was obsessed with this character, and I bought that little outfit at Aardvark, which was on Melrose at the time, this, that 70s, as Pete liked to call it, the clown suit. And the dirt, you know, filth, how, I thought, what would be the ugly, you know, what would be the ugliest woman on the earth? And the whole thing.
So that is your hair? Is that your hair?
That was my hair.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And I went, I put, like, egg white on my face to make it all scaly, because my mom used to give herself an egg white mask.
Yeah, right.
And it would always look terrible when she before she took it off. So I experimented with that, and I would literally for like 3 weeks I sat on my floor in my bedroom trying to figure out this character, and I still didn't have an audition. And I read in the trades they were about a week away from principal photography, and I my agent just died. This is true. And I'm sitting at the I was supposed to have a meeting with somebody and they had canceled, and I'm sitting at my dining room table, and this was the best thing my ex-husband ever did for me, truly. He came in, he said, "What's the matter?" I said, "My agent's dead. I can't get an audition." And I said, "I've been working on Mrs. Dumars, you know, for weeks, and they won't see me." And he said, "Well, why don't you call Steve Stabler, who was one of the producers on Dumb and Dumber and is a sweetheart of a guy." And I said, and he says, "Go on, it's 4 o'clock. He's probably just finished lunch. He'll probably pick up the phone." And it was one of those moments where I called. Steve answered, and I said the same thing. He said, "What's up?" And I said, I've worked on this audition, and I'd really love to come in. And he said, "Well, we really don't think you're right." The door was closing. The gates were closing like
right.
on Yom Kippur. You know? And I said I worked out this whole presentation. He said, "All right, come on in on Thursday." So literally, I dressed up in my little outfit with the egg on my face and the grease in my hair, and I had eyelashes coming out of my nostrils, so it looked like I had nose hairs. And I got to Santa Monica. They were, I guess, it's 1401 Ocean. You know that big building in Santa Monica. The parking lot attendant flung himself against a wall when I got in the car. And he said, I said, no, I'm going, no, this is not me. I said, where's the, I'm not sure where the building is. And so he kind of just pointed.
Man. You gave a poor little Mexican guy a
complete heart attack. I came in, I sat down on the floor, and Rick Montgomery, he walked by me 3 times. He thought I was a homeless woman off of from the beach.
So they didn't even know it was you.
No. And then he said, "Lynn," and he brought me in. And I was so I did the audition, which of course never went as well as it could have gone because there was no way it could have. I had rehearsed it so many times in my head, there was no way it was going to match my own expectations.
Yeah, right.
But long story short, I walked out of there, and the next day, I was just sort of deflated. You know, it's like that moment where you post orgasm, where you just go, "Oh God, you know, nothing's ever going to happen again." And
you're smoking.
And
yeah.
So anyway, I called Steve to thank him the next day, and he said, "I'm not supposed to tell you, but we hired you." And that was how I got that
story.
Job.
So they didn't even expect you to even be good.
No, well they like, they no they
they
didn't.
Know you're great, but they're like, not for this.
And that's what Pete said. He said before I walked in, he later told me this. He said to everybody, "Well, we'll see."
It was just like
a
bullshit general to be nice.
Yeah.
And
when I came in, I didn't break character for 1 minute, and they said they were on the floor when I left.
That's
long
great.
Story short. So when I got this part to work with Woody, which is how I got to this story, I was so excited and so nervous because this was something that was really totally my little creation. And he was such a team player and fell so in love with what I was doing. And I still, to this day, those are my favorite scenes I have ever done in
They're
a
film. They're great. They're
great. It's a perfectly arced character.
I think Kingpin's the perfect movie, too.
I do, too. I do, too. I think it's their best film.
You think it's
I'm with you. I think
do.
It's their best.
I think it's their best film, and I love Dumb and Dumber.
And I
love
something,
about
too.
Mary, sure.
But
I like
this
Stuck
one is
on
the
You
best.
A lot. I love the Farrelly Brothers, but their best film is Kingpin, yes.
And I honestly, I think I still get stopped more for that. Unfortunately, I think I'm starting to look like her, but...
No, and like, but I just think every scene of that movie works. Every single one.
I agree
one.
With you.
And
yeah,
so
right.
comedy click like that.
Yeah. I've seen it a few times, but it's been a while. I'm going to revisit
it
now.
It's really worth looking at again. And I have to say, you know, we're talking about objectifying yourself, because I don't like to look at myself when I'm on camera if it's me.
Yeah.
But as that character, I can completely own her when I look at that. I go, that will never be taken away from the
world. I'm curious about that, though, because I just got done writing a pilot that's very, like, it's very funny, but there's sex in it, you know? And, it, like, a lot of sex, you know, like, gritty
that's
sex.
That's why it's funny.
Okay, so, yeah, that is why it's funny. But when you
read
that kind of stuff as an actress, do you have any concerns or anything about that kind of material?
You know,
there's something about Mary too. They have the prosthetic breasts they put on you and stuff. Is that weird for you?
No, because when it's a good story, I'll do anything.
That's great.
And if I trust my director, I'll do anything.
And you trust the Farrelly brothers?
Completely. They really know. They know how to make their brand funny.
Are they squeezing you into Dumb and Dumber too?
I hope they will. I don't know because
they brought back the kid that has the dead parrot.
I know.
They could bring you back.
Do you know what? Somebody on Facebook had a very funny idea.
What was that?
To bring Mrs. Dumars in for one day
to be
the landlady.
That would be great. That's not just a funny idea, that's a genius idea.
And so I said you should ask them. I mean, I don't think they will because whatever they're doing, they're doing. I haven't spoken to them. I adore them. I have the highest love and regard for them, literally. First of all, they changed my life.
Their manager's a friend of mine. I'm going to bug the shit out of her about it.
But you know what they said to me, which is still to this day, you know, because you go in on these auditions, and you go in and you try, and still I go in and don't get the jobs at this point in time. But they said to me, you weren't right for this role, but you came in and you were the only person that really told us what it was, and you were the best person. You were the best person, best actress for the part.
That's great.
Yeah, it wasn't like
you know that was crazy for me too about your career, and it's not Farrelly Brothers related. Is you were on the last episode of like one of my favorite shows ever, ER.
Yes,
And I thought it was great that you got on ER.
That was seriously.
And how to be on the series finale?
Yep.
What was that like?
First of all, I've auditioned. I don't get a lot of TV, and not because I don't want to, although I prefer films because I love the pacing of films.
Yeah.
Television is about money and time often.
Yeah.
And you know, a show like ER was spectacular. John Levy, who's been a friend for years, I've been in to audition, and I went in to audition for that, and the director fell out of his chair laughing.
For ER?
When I did the audition.
Who was the director on that final episode?
My God.
You remember?
Was it
Chulak?
He directed the first episode and he directed the last. He's was an awesome, tough cookie.
I don't remember who it was either.
We have to Google that because I should remember his name.
Yeah.
And
Wells there? Were those guys there?
Yep. So I thought, I either got this job or I'll never work this town again. And it was interesting. I learned something really fabulous from him because I don't get a lot to. I've never been cast in a lot of television, and he really gave us all opportunity. It was probably because it was the end of the show, and we did it, and then he kept saying that he would give me really technical notes, like don't let your voice get high. I mean, it was like musical direction. And then he would say, you got to slow up here. And he says, now do whatever you want. Take it as high as you want and go as low as you want. He really let me play with the role. And then the final take, which is what they used, he said, now do it like you're reading from a telephone book. And let me tell you something. What I learned, and this is like an acting exercise, everything I did was in that final version. Because as an instrument, we take all that in. I mean, we become everything you think and do.
Rod Holcomb, Pat says. Rod Holcomb.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was awesome.
That's great.
And he really took to me. I mean, I think he really had regard for what I brought in.
Right.
And the fact is that the comedy was too broad for the place in the show because I was so funny. I mean, the crew was on there. They were just on the floor.
Yeah.
And but when I saw the final, it was a two episode curve. This character comes in about 15 minutes in, and I think Susie Kurtz and another wonderful actress are at the end. There's a very funny scene with them on gurneys. These two women from a wedding party,
they're having a fight.
Yeah, they get into an argument. That they saved. They couldn't have had me be that funny that early on in the show. I mean, it was the wrong tone.
It was the right tone to close it with, though.
So they closed perfectly with it, and then
it's such a funny profession, acting, because I mean, if it's a profession at all for most people who want to be actors, because it's the only art form where you need someone else's permission to practice it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you're a writer, you can get up in the morning, grab your computer and write, grab a notepad and pen. If you're a musician, you can grab a guitar. Like with acting, You're waiting on a phone call, and it's just such a frustrating thing. And I really admire people who just act, who go through that life, who aren't dabbling in other things to sort of.
But that's the one thing for acting. But for writing, it's a different kind of rejection and a different kind of direction. You have studio people giving you notes.
There's
that too. And
but
I mean,
at least you can do it.
How many scripts have you written that haven't been produced? I'm assuming a few, right?
Yeah,
everybody.
There is a few that I'm still hoping to get made. You know. But I do like the fact that you can just get up and do it.
Sure.
You are right. If it doesn't get made, I mean, it's kind of like the tree falling in the forest film. Like, if you write a screenplay and it doesn't get made into a film, does it even exist?
Right, exactly.
Like, it's nothing.
Yeah, right.
It's a pile
That's
of pages in a drawer.
When I write something, too. I go, well, if this never sees the light of day, it's nice.
Yeah, right.
Great.
I mean, every screenplay makes you a better writer, so it's not like it was
That's
a waste
true.
Of your time, but it's... For a couple of years there, I actually kind of burnt out on writing and said, I want to make a few of these films. And this year's been great because I've made like three films back to back that I've written. And I'm so excited that they're actually getting made. Instead of just drawing up the plans for a house, the house has been built.
And Insidious 2 is the first one, right?
Insidious 2, we shot that early this year. Then I went back to Australia to shoot a film with the guy who plays...
With Angus.
With Angus, who plays Tucker in the film.
Yeah.
He and I wrote a film together called The Mule, about a drug mule.
That's cool. You guys made a good team in that, too.
Oh, thanks. We did this film in Australia. It's kind of like a crime thriller... Black comedy, almost like Fargo-esque in tone.
Well, you guys have like a Simon Pegg McFrost thing
going on.
You kind of got that going on.
Right. Oh, that would be nice. After that, I shot a film, Cooties, that I'm really excited about.
Yeah?
I almost was in it, but I never got the
I know. I texted Lynn, but it just didn't happen.
Oh. Isn't that awful? This, I'm still...
When
I'm
you
still
don't get
looking.
A And it would be right up Lynn's alley. Here's the pitch for Cooties. Okay, it's
I'm going to moan.
I'm going to say comedy horror, not horror comedy, because the comedy is first and foremost to me. It's about a foodborne virus that comes from chicken nuggets that breaks out at an elementary school, but the virus only affects you if you have not gone through puberty. So if you've gone through puberty, you're safe from this virus.
That's your vaccine.
So all the children at this elementary school in the middle of America somewhere get turned into these like cannibalistic savages, and the teachers have to defend themselves. They're holed up
That's
inside
awesome.
The school gym. It's
That's
basically
funny.
Like Dawn of the Dead with little kids.
Take that, World War Z.
Yeah, exactly. Really. It's World War Z meets Kindergarten Cop.
Yeah, right.
And
was that your elevator pitch?
Yeah, exactly. That was the elevator pitch. But we had a really good cast. We had Elijah Wood, Rainn Wilson from The Office.
That's great.
Alison Pill from The Newsroom.
Yeah.
Jack McBrayer from 30 Rock.
Okay.
Nassim.
So they all play teachers?
Yeah, they all play the teachers. And that was amazing to be acting opposite them. You know, I sent a tweet that said it was like learning to swim by diving off Niagara Falls. It was like, I'm trying to learn comedy watching these guys do it. But that's the only way I can get acting roles, is to write the film and then make it a contractual obligation that they put me in it.
Have you ever seen that? I was going to ask you, like, do you
tell
them
Lee,
I need
good.
To act in this?
Yeah,
you're
like,
pretty
by the way,
good actor.
That guy
pretty
does.
Damn good
that's
actor.
Me.
Yeah. You are a good actor.
Oh,
you
I
are good.
You're you know what? How I gauge it? Seriously. I mean, you
by
were,
the amount of women that
well,
constantly
that too,
approaching
but.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's exactly
no,
what it is.
No, but seriously, you are so present there. You know, like, look at you. You're right. I mean, you're right here.
Right.
No, but you and Patrick's like that, too. But you'd be surprised
Listen,
how many
dude,
actors
I told
are
you,
not.
You disappeared in this. I saw you yesterday.
It was like Ben Kingsley in Gandhi.
No, I mean, to be honest, I didn't recognize you when you came up to me. Because I'm thinking speck, and I'm thinking...
I have that problem,
that
though. I photograph
American
differently
accent.
Than I look in real life.
You do.
You're really
do.
Cute in real life and on camera, Lee.
Look
Let me just
Lynn.
Put it there.
Lynn Shea should be your agent.
I know.
You need Lynn to
In real life, I'm okay. On camera, I look like late-period Val Kilmer.
There you go.
like MacGruber era
you kind
Val
of,
Kilmer.
You kind of are like the thin Val Kilmer. You're like... what's the movie that he did in the... Top Secret, Val Kilmer.
Top Secret.
That's where you are.
That's Vintage Kilmer.
That's Vintage Kilmer, which gets heard all the time. Vintage Kilmer.
Yeah.
He's really amazing, though. He just did that Mark Twain play in L.A. A one-man show where he wrote, directed it, and he dresses up as Mark Twain, like the whole thing.
Now, is he
thing,
crazy as a shithouse rat?
Sure.
I mean, it has to be true.
Sure, but I think he's cool crazy, right?
I actually
right.
worked with him on a little film.
Which thing did you work with
It was called him? American Cowslip.
I haven't seen it.
And he plays a cop in it.
Did you get to work with, like,
yeah,
in the scene
with him? Yeah, I
did.
How was he?
He was very professional, and he brought all the women's flowers.
Do you love everybody?
No, yeah. Not at all.
Your brother has to not love anybody. I'm imagining your brother doesn't like anybody.
No, Bob is just very, he's definitely, like, evaluates you before you can evaluate him.
Do you see Bob Shea, for people listening and don't know, he used to run New Line. And like,
he didn't just run it,
he created it, right. Huge. So, like, growing up and growing older with Bob, and you watch Bob progress, did you ever feel like, What are the misconceptions about his job that people may not understand? They may be like, oh, studio executive, and they think whatever. But what does he have to go through that's, like, hard?
He literally started this business. I was living in what we called the mole hole. He had a 5-story railroad apartment on 13th Street and 2nd Avenue in New York. And it was one of these railroad apartments. Bob went to University of Michigan, then graduated from Columbia Law School and had a Fulbright scholarship.
You guys
to
are both Michigan people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he went to Columbia, and then he had a Fulbright to Sweden for 2 years. And really, Bob is so smart. And yeah. I mean,
he has to be to build a company like that from the ground up.
My dad was very much involved with us, you know, in our trying to guide us as all good parents try. And he told Bob he should go to law school and become go into business. But Bob was a photographer when he was a kid. My parents made a little dark room for him in our basement, and with a curtain. And he had all the equipment, the enlarger, and all the chemicals. And he used to develop his own photographs. And he was really talented. And then he made a couple of short films. One of them is owned by the Museum of Modern Art. It's called Image.
Oh, wow.
Toured all the festivals, and he made, and everything was, you know, he built his own dollies, and he loved movies.
He loved them.
And so, long story short, he went and had all this business, education. And he came back, and he decided he was going to start a distribution company. And he came home one day, literally, with a piece of stationery. I even remember the name of the designer. His name was Peter Roche, who was a wonderful graphic designer who came up with the New Line logo. Am I doing this?
Oh. I'm fascinated by the story, but it keeps going off mic as a listener at home.
We got to teach Lynn how to be a stand-up comedian with the mic. Chris Rocket.
Okay, long story short.
No, I could listen to Bob Shea stories all day.
And anyway, he decided to start this company. He acquired 3 films.
Well, I want to hear about the piece of stationery.
So it was this beautiful logo. It said New Line Cinema.
Not the one that's today?
Not today. That's only the second one, though, which was also Bob designed, I think, with someone. I don't think it was Peter, though. But this was like this beautiful, like vibrated. It looked like it was this really, I bet you can find it online somewhere. It's the old logo. And he acquired 3 films, and one was called Martyrs of Love by a Czechoslovakian filmmaker named Jan Nemec.
Okay.
One called The Virgin President, which was all the Second City people, Anthony Holland.
I'm from Second City.
Okay, so Anthony Holland, Paul Benedict.
That's great.
And the third was called Valley, the Witch of Positano, which was a documentary by the Rockland brothers, who I think.
You are such a good sister. You could remember all this about your brother. I don't know my brother's kid's name.
No, seriously.
I don't know what his daughter's name is. I have no idea. I'm going to take a stab at Jessica.
But this was, so he paid nothing and was given these 3 movies and started a business. And he had a secretary named Vivian who was a macrobiotic secretary. He worked out of his living room.
Wow.
And he started New Line Cinema. And
what
very
was
slowly,
his first success?
That one.
Yeah, what was
the red one.
What was like the first big hit out of New Line? Do you remember?
Yes. Well, it was first.
Oh yeah, that's
the red
a very
one.
Cool.
And it looks
logo.
Like it was. You know, it,
that's
it,
really cool.
It had so much energy to
I'd
it.
I'd love to see him. I would love to see them use that actually in like a film. Like it would be kind of.
I think
cool
he did
in
the, maybe because the very first movie they actually made was a movie called Stunts.
I haven't seen that.
Which was with Robert Forrester, I think, and Fiona Lewis. God, how do I remember
all
this
stuff? I
haven't
seen it. I love Robert Forrester.
Well, it's called Stunts, STUNTS, and it's kind of a murder mystery. And I believe that was the first film they actually produced. But before that, they did all these lecture series and They distributed like the Rolling Stones films.
Oh, wow.
and Robert Bresson. What was the first big hit?
Yeah,
was there a hit?
The first big hit was Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's, which was 1984.
20 years later, like 16 years later, they got the first huge hit.
And I used to joke with Bob, his hands were always freezing. Because the company was always going under. I mean, and he literally, but that he started out in, he used to joke, he'd say, I get up in the morning, go through the office to the bathroom, then I go back to the office, then I go to the kitchen, then I go back to the office, I go back to the bathroom, I go back to the office, and I go to bed.
That was his
life until he finally got
That's great.
And very slowly, and I think the next big deal for him was when he got the rights to Cocaine Fiends and Madness, what was it called? Reefer Madness.
Reefer Madness, yeah.
And there's a great story. Charlie Rose did a wonderful interview with him and Michael Lynn where I learned a lot of stuff about Bob and New Line, which I didn't know.
I'm going to have to search that. I like that.
Reefer Madness was owned by some woman. I think she lived in Philadelphia because she was in love with the whoever the main guy was who played the role. I don't know who it was. And Bob went to find her and visit her.
He, like, hunted her down.
Hunted her down, and she gave him the movie.
Wow.
And she wouldn't take any money at that time. And she gave him the movie. She said, if you want to take it and try and do something with it, here, take it.
Man.
And
For free.
And that's then he gave her and Bob is, like, one of those people. This is, again, I have such high regard. He's one of the most loyal, honest people I've ever met, ever. And he can be ruthless when he needs something to happen. And his company has a lot of, when it was the original New Line, had these loyal employees. Sometimes you'd walk in there, you think it was like a family dinner. Everybody'd be yelling at each other, and then it would be over. And Bob was like, they would do anything for him. And
Is he just kind of done with the business now?
No, he's got a new company called Unique Features.
Okay.
And Mortal Instruments is the first thing they've produced.
Is that what they did?
Yeah.
Mortal Instruments. Okay.
And
so that's great.
And he's been, but you know, they're not the big finances that they had now. And the new line is.
Oh no, they're not making very many movies. Yeah.
James did The Conjuring. That's probably
their best. That was the
first time in a long time.
And I can say this:
I
wish it was with Bob Shea.
Yeah,
I know.
That's all I can say. I'm so thrilled that
I get. And let's not forget. I mean, Bob is the reason the Farrelly Brothers got their launch too.
I mean, think about New Line as a company. There was a golden age there
in the 90s
where they were making amazing films in the 90s.
And Mike DeLuca had the best taste in the planet.
Oh my God!
And now he's working with Dana Brunetti on things.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about Seven, Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Austin Powers,
Dumb and Dumber,
Dumb and Dumber,
the Elm Street series,
The Mask,
Cameron Diaz's first role.
It was so diverse.
Chuck Russell.
Yep.
And I don't
Chuck
know
Russell.
If there's any other studio or company that I can think of now whose slate is that diverse to go from Seven to Boogie Nights to Austin Powers to, it's just amazing. Oh, here. I
think Warner Brothers is trying because Warner Brothers is kind of spread all out, which is good. But they now all have these subsidiary companies.
Well,
because
New Line originally was sold. It was an independent company.
Right.
They sold it to Ted Turner.
Yes.
And Ted and
before
Bob.
Before the AOL merger.
Yes.
Well,
it was before Warner Brothers, too.
Right.
And Ted and Bob were two peas in a pod.
Ted
would
have taken really good care of the company.
And he took good care of everybody.
Yes.
Ted is a very
He's a great loyal guy. Yeah.
Just he and Bob are very similar in many, many,
I
many ways.
I believe it. That would
and
be
they very
I would
good
love
friends.
To be a fly in the wall those two hanging out.
Yeah.
I also want to hear stories from your brother about the making of Island of Dr. Moreau.
I'm in on that. Speaking of Val Kilmer.
I mean, you might as well. You put Kilmer and Brando in a room.
Oh, man.
I think you'd have to ask Bob about
those
stories.
Cheesecake. That's all I want.
Yeah, right. I bet you Bob only knows stories from the phone because he would not even probably go to that.
They shot that film in Australia as far away as it could be.
They're remaking it.
They are.
They're remaking it again. I just read about
it the
other day.
That's crazy.
It's one of those properties you can keep reinventing, Dracula or something.
They're
going to
make
old
it
enough.
Kinda like
Oh, and listen, I have one other thing to tell you,
kind of thing. Yeah.
Which I hadn't really. If it wasn't for Bob, I probably would not have the career I have, and I'll tell you
really?
Why. Yep. He always, because he's a very interesting guy in terms of brother-sisterhood.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, get your own fucking job. You know, like, but behind my back, he apparently really was very complimentary about, you know, about my possibilities at that time especially. And it was Dumb and Dumber, which is the way I met the Fairleys. I got a call saying there was a scene in this film, and I knew it was a New Line project, and and they wanted you to do the scene, and so I was all excited. This is Mrs. Neugeborger. So I called Bob. I said, do I have you to thank for this? And that was, he said, oh, go get your own fucking job, and blah, 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 blah. And that was it. And so I thought, okay,
he was trying to play it off like,
yeah,
I had nothing to do with this.
And I thought, oh, well, maybe somebody saw me in this, or maybe somebody saw me in that. And I kind of forgot about it.
Maybe it was going south.
Maybe it was going south.
I got to ask you about that when you're done, though.
That's a great story.
So how'd you find out it was Bob?
Okay, so I did the job, and I did well. It was a good. I had a real great idea. I wanted to do make myself look like a French poodle because how people look like their dogs. And at the end of it, it said she screams when she opens the van door. And I said to Pete, "What about if I whimper instead, like oh, oh, oh?" And he loved it. And even you know Jeff Daniels says, "Oh, that's great. You know, we love that." So long story short, so I did good. I did a good job. I came home. About 2 months later, I get a note in the mail, and it's from Bob, and it says, for your scrapbook. That was the, and I opened the letter. I still have this on my desk, and I'm going to make me cry probably. It was a note from Charlie Wessler, who was one of the producers of Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
And it said, dear Bob, usually when the head of a studio recommends a family member, we all want to puke. And he said, but I just want to tell you what a fantastic job your sister did, and it was so, so great to have her.
That's
right.
Cool.
That's really cool.
And if it wasn't, and
you should post that on Facebook.
It's really private.
I don't usually
tell people that story either, but if it wasn't for Bob Shea, I never would have met the Farrelly brothers, probably.
Yeah.
I never would have had the opportunity, and like, what Pete says is he says, you know, you create your own. You know, he says, you got an opportunity, but you turned it. You spun straw into gold.
And you did it again with Kingpin.
And that's what you did with Kingpin. Yeah. But without that opportunity, and it's like, and that's why I always say to people, don't be afraid to let someone help you.
Yeah.
You know, people get so like, oh, my God, and you don't have to depend on that.
It's just who is going to.
Don't be afraid.
The thing is,
if somebody reaches out their hand, take it.
There's a thin line in L.A. I've noticed where it's like asking for help and if people are going to reach out to try to help you. And like, it's true.
I never asked.
Right.
I never asked, Bob. Ever.
Right.
I knew
but it really comes down to, the thing is, the only favor someone can do for you in L.A. is to get you in a door. I mean, maybe the producer of some film is like, you know, my sister play female lead, yes. You know, that's the scary Russian mafia producer.
Yeah, right.
But other than that, it's usually just ushering you through a door. Once you get through the door,
you have to deliver.
Whether it's an acting audition or a screenplay you've written, if I call you, if I'm the head of a studio and I call some director and I say, hey, my brother wrote a script, I want you to look at it, I think it's your next movie. If that director reads that script and it's terrible, he's not going to do it.
Yeah. Right.
It's not nepotism and all this stuff. It only gets you through a door. You've got to have the goods. And so if anyone asks me about screenwriting, like, what are your tips? I'm just like, my tips are write.
Yeah, right.
Just keep writing.
When you write that script that is good enough that people take notice of it, people will fight tooth and nail to get to it because they're starved for good material. It's not going to be because my uncle knows this guy who sold a car to this chick who runs the shit. I mean, I don't believe
So what
in
happens
that.
Once you write the great screenplay? Let's say you're a nobody. Let's say before you move to L.A., you're a great screenplay writer from Omaha. How do you get it out there?
You send it to agencies.
Yeah, you just got to pay.
Really?
I think that works?
If it's a truly great screenplay and you send it to an agency out here and, you know, you make protect yourself, maybe get yourself a lawyer, register it with the Writers Guild.
Sure.
You send it, someone will call you back. It might not be CAA or the biggest agency in town, but someone will call you back and say, hey, I read your script.
Because most
it's
of
really
them don't
great.
Have unsolicited submissions, right?
Yeah, but agencies do because they're always looking for
they're
material.
They're looking for stuff.
It's more studios that don't look for... They don't want unsolicited material, but agencies want submissions. And they kick it down to
not
the intern
CAA,
or whatever.
Not CAA, though. They don't want a submission. position.
Well, I bet you even they have a department. They can't afford to be out of that game.
Yeah. You know, I remember Bob, this is something that Bob used to say. He'd read anything.
Really?
Yep. Actually, there's a. Do you know who
All
Jeff?
Right,
do you know,
Bob, you got like you know, seven scripts
wait,
on your
wait, do you know
what
Jeff
is that
Katz?
Envelope you're putting together?
Wait, do you know Jeff Katz?
Yes.
You know, okay, do you know how Jeff Katz got started?
No.
When he was 8 years old, he sent a treatment to Bob.
No way.
I swear to God. This
really?
Is true. Now, I may have the age
Did
wrong.
Did Bob know he was that young? Or around
I don't,
that
I
ballpark?
Don't, he wrote Bob a letter and sent him a thing from about Nightmare and wanted to be, it said he wanted to be, you know, make movies and blah, blah, blah. And Bob gave him an opportunity for real when he came. And Jeff worked his way up in New Line and now is like doing his own, I don't know, he's got his own company,
oh,
I think,
man.
Now.
Yeah.
But,
good
but
on him. That's great.
What was
you
I
gotta,
doing when I was eight?
But to be open.
Yeah, why weren't
idea.
We that enterprising?
Why wasn't I writing you know, Bob Shea when
can,
I was eight?
You can get away with
I mean,
so
really,
much when you're eight. Like if you had written
he
to Steven
wrote him
Spielberg
a treatment.
With an
he
idea.
Wrote him a treatment for
I'm gonna, I'm going to write Bob Shea and Sam 8, but I'm just like Robin Williams and Jack.
I'm sure Bob's ears are burning.
Show up as an 8-year-old and just right. And maybe have a carer who's like, mentally, he's 8.
Yeah, right. We should try to pull off the Robin Williams and Jack thing.
But,
that
you know,
could,
it, that thing about being proactive is sort of an overused term, but it's really true. You just got to, like, throw, like, even that thing with Kingpin. I mean, I had a lot of balls to do that, I guess, but I didn't think about it like that because I was just so, I just had
yeah,
a, like, I had a try.
That word proactive always reminds me of the episode of The Simpsons where they're writing an animated film and yep. the studio guy goes, we need this guy to be more proactive. And the writer says, isn't proactive just a word dumb people use to make themselves sound smarter? And then there's just a pause.
Or
and
is
like,
it an acne medication?
He pauses and then he goes, I'm fired, aren't I?
Yeah, right.
and the guy goes, oh, yeah.
That's good.
There's a Jack Nicholson story about going
I
south,
I was
going
to ask you about that because Jack Nicholson's like my idol. I love him.
He's a force of nature for sure. He's, I mean,
yeah.
I'm Lloyd.
You got to have a Jack story.
Well, my wonderful Jack Nicholson story is I was living in New York and I was doing theater and I had just gotten fired from a play. And I didn't realize that years later.
Who replaced you? Nobody.
Somebody.
Nobody.
Nobody.
Look where Lynn Shea is now.
I think her name was Myril Streep.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
It was, I don't know who she was, what she's doing now, but if you're out there, Myril.
We wish you a lot of good luck.
Myril Streep. I think it might have been Streep, too.
Yeah, right.
I can't remember.
That's right. Again. Somebody spelled it wrong is how it became Streep.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got a rash. It was very unhappy.
Oh.
This
just took a left turn. I got fired.
No,
I got a rash.
It was out my own. I was seeing the dermatologist. No, not really. But I get a call from my agent at the time. I did. My agent was not dead yet. This guy was actually there.
This was the living
this
agent.
This was the living agent. And he said. Jack Nicholson, they were in town, and he had seen a picture of me somewhere, and they wanted to know more information. So, and I'm going, ooh, you know, I'm like, what do you mean? And they said, well, and it's a movie called Going South that they're going to be making. Marion Doherty's the casting director, and they have been in New York. They're actually on their way back to Los Angeles now, but we're sending your packet of information. Now, the only thing I could think of is it might have been the Players Directory. I mean, I have no idea where they would have seen a picture or whatever, and I certainly my pictures were not that great to begin with. But anyway, so I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I'm like, oh, my, OMG. They didn't even know about OMG yet, but it was
you
like, OMG.
Hated OMG at that moment.
Oh. So I started, this is how, I guess, very naive I am, but it kind of works in your behalf some of the time. I started accumulating every picture I could find of myself. This is me with curly hair. This is me laughing. This is me smiling. This is me. This is me with lipstick on. This is me without lipstick. I mean, I had this like little packet of pictures, and I wrote this note and I said, "Dear Mr. Nicholson, I'm so glad to hear that you are interested." And I said, "These are some other looks.
This is how
I
look
right,
in any
is,
way you need
this
me.
Is, right, any way you need me, this is how I could look." And I remember I wrote it on 7777 because sevens have been a very big number in my life for real. And I had this little card. It was called the Soothsayer.
That's
and
so insidious, too, by the
oh,
way.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
really,
it really,
really
is.
So I wrote it on
7777.
And I put the whole thing in an envelope. And then as an afterthought at the last minute, I took it out and I wrote on the bottom, P.S. I plan to be in Los Angeles for a short visit in the next week, which was a complete lie.
Yeah, right, right.
So I put it together. I give it to them. I put it in the mail. I send it like was express. They didn't even have express. Who knows? This was at Bridie Murphy's day. It was like 1977. So literally the next day or whatever I get a call from my agent. They said, "Do you know him?" And I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, Jack just called. I mean, it wasn't really Jack. I'm sure it was his. And they want to meet you as soon as you're in Los Angeles." So I literally packed dirty laundry. This is the truth. Talk about being proactive. I packed my bag. I took my credit card to the airport. I got on a plane to L.A. the next day. That was how I stayed at the Chateau Marmont, because Betty Buckley, who's an extraordinary singer.
Great actress and great acting coach and teacher.
She's an extraordinary.
I believe she's teaching in Texas or something.
Yeah, she's
right?
from Texas. And she was a cowgirl. She used to do barrel racing.
She's great. Broadway actor.
A voice. She, was the original Esmeralda in Cats.
Yeah, she's great.
And we were very good friends. And I took a class with her in New York that was based on singing for actors. So we had become very good friends. And she had come out here to do Eight Is Enough, because the original actress on that series died, and she got hired to play the mother. So she was out here doing Lorimar. It was Lorimar at the time, doing a Lorimar series.
Yeah.
And she said, "Come on, you stay at the Chateau with me, and no problem." So I flew out here, and I got a fever blister on the plane the size of a basketball. I mean, I was so stressed out. But I was like, "Oh, I guess I still, if I put a lot of makeup, I'll be fine." I check into the Chateau. I call, my appointment is like for 10 o'clock the next morning, and I remember putting on coats of mascara thinking, if I can just make my eyes really accentuate my eyes, he maybe won't notice my mouth, which I'm not joking. It was like, you can't see this. Like, it was like,
yeah, the Elvis
like there were 14. I had like a cluster. It was called an outbreak cluster of a fever blizzard. And so I walk into his office. And at Paramount, I'd never been out here, so I took a cab to Paramount. I walk into his office, and he's sitting, he's got his head down, he's got my resume in his hand and my pictures up on his board.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh my God, oh my God. I said, "Hello," and he looks up at me with that with that typical classic Nicholson look, and he says, "What happened to your mouth?" and I said, "Oh no, I didn't really just come out here to meet you." It was like I was stammering and stuttering, and he just said, "I've been living with actresses long enough to know how hard that must be." And he said, "Well, let's see what you got here." And he started telling me about this movie, and he said, "This is for a small role, but it's a very special project to me, and I want special people in it."
Yeah.
That was it. And Harry Giddens.
Right. Did you and Mary Steenburgen ever meet?
Wait. Yeah. No, listen. She had just gotten cast. She got cast. She was a waitress sitting in the waiting room when he brought her in to read, and he hired her on the spot. He's like that.
Right.
He's just like, so I came out back from the audition. I got another job right away, like on a movie of the week. Oh, we have to go.
Are they taking it? Yeah,
they're taking it away.
You gotta go.
We are live.
Lee doesn't want to be here anymore.
No. It's just I'm happy to. I didn't know we were live. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said, "Hey, I gotta go."
You could be the guy. You are the first guy to cut me off.
Thanks.
Anyway,
French guy.
I'll just finish up.
I told you he was a pretentious French asshole.
Look at his nose. Look how beautiful that nose is. It's like a Michelangelo nose.
What's your favorite Billy Joel song before you go?
Ooh. Favorite Billy Joel song. I do love New York State of Mind.
Okay.
Do love that. I think She's Always a Woman to Me. Now, is that the title of the song? I am hungover. She's Always a Woman to Me, I think, is my favorite.
Yeah.
What about you?
Ooh, I like Go to Extremes. I like a lot of his earlier work too. Go to Extremes.
You go to Extremes.
Yeah, that he wrote about Claudia Schiffer, I believe it was, right? That's when they were married. Yeah, it's about her.
Oh, you mean Christie Brinkley?
Christie Brinkley.
Christie Brinkley.
I get him and Copperfield confused. They look so much alike.
Copperfield is hilarious.
They do so much similar work.
Well, what I love about this Billy Joel T-shirt I'm wearing is that it is in a heavy metal font.
I know, and it doesn't even have Billy on it.
It doesn't look like Billy Joel. It looks like a Slayer T-shirt.
Right.
But you look close enough at it, and it's Billy Joel.
Well, let's do the
been
hard.
Trying to hip up.
Let's do the hard sell real quick for Insidious 2, Chapter 2.
Yep.
By the way, are we looking at a third one?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, the film comes out this Friday, so we'll have to see how the film does in theaters.
If you get a great story.
People, you know, I mean, I guess with sequels it becomes all about numbers, so they'll see how it does. And I haven't really put too much thought into another one because I'm so superstitious.
Yeah. Are you out of the Jimmy Wan business now that he's doing Fast 7?
Well, I mean, out of the Fast and Furious business, it is an interesting time for me because I've been...
Doing
such
your
a
own
duo
stuff
with
too.
Him.
Yeah.
For
but,
so no, long.
But you're now doing your own
you
stuff.
Squeeze you in Fast 7.
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting
like
for that
Paul
call, James.
Walker's
the cameo.
Like
James said he was going to try and find a role for me to kick Vin Diesel's ass.
That'd be
said,
good.
You know who I
want
to be
that.
In Fast and Furious?
I don't.
I want to be that tech nerd in the film where the muscle-bound guys go, can you enhance there?
Yeah, and then they make fun of you with their muscles.
They scoot over on the desk chair, and it's always like, they always do a 10-second like, I don't know. And it's total non-typing. They're just banging the keys, and they're like, looks like I got it.
You did one like, bad thing, though, there. They never even look at the keyboard. They're always
It's always
I have
like,
no idea if I can do
but
this.
But they always give it 10 seconds, like, do you think you could get the password for that?
Yeah, right.
I don't know.
Right.
Got it.
I just think you'd be great, because they always bully around that guy in the movies, too. They're always like, we're the good guy heroes, but we push around little people.
Yeah,
they're good people, too, but we push you around.
Yeah, exactly.
Know
like,
your place,
you got a date tonight,
guy.
Griffin? I actually do.
Right.
Whatever. Just get us the password to the vault, genius. I'm not sure I can do that. It's encrypted with a laser gate. I got it.
I got it.
Turns out he named his password after his cat. I don't know why the nerd became a New York guy all of a sudden. How did that transformation happen?
I gotta see you do more comedy.
I know he really. Lee's a stand-up.
I'm good
also.
With that. You are.
Here's the thing.
You're
I've done a few stand-up gigs, right? I've done a few stand-up gigs.
Out here or back home?
I did a few in LA. I mean, in Melbourne. And when I say a few, I mean literally five. And then I've done like five in LA. But here's my thing with stand-up. A couple of my friends have said to me, oh, you know, I saw you do that open mic, the stand-up. You should do it. And I'm like, it's too late. Like, I don't know how much experience you have with stand-up, but I'm like, don't you need... You need to put 10 years of going across the country doing, like, the ha-ha hole in Cincinnati.
Yep.
And you're there in front of five drunk people. 10 years of that before you get to Louis C.K.
Frustrated.
It's too late. I think if you're going to do that for 10 years, you need to start when you're 20, when pain is romantic. Yep. And sleeping in
well,
a
that's how the show started. I got sick of doing stand-up for 100 people, so I decided to start
How
this.
Long did you do that? And you were looking to
years.
Do that 10 years.
Years.
So you, years. That ha-ha hole I talked about,
the
you've been there.
Hole for years, yeah. Oh, I've been worse.
What's it like to turn up to a club in a strip mall in a suburb outside Houston and be like, oh, man, I'm on at 12 midnight. I'm going to do a set.
I'm kind of a fuck it guy, so even when it doesn't go well, I used to drink. I'd go out back and have a scotch and smoke and be like, whatever. Fuck them.
Whatever.
Yeah. I would just be totally cool about it. Like, I would secretly be depressed. Like, I mean, obviously you want to make it and you want to be performing in front of hundreds and hundreds of people, but there's nothing you can really do about failure other than get up and do
not
something
whatever.
Else.
I think what you can do about it is what you're doing right now. Like,
right, that's
you go,
what it is.
You suddenly go, it's like a rat in a maze. You know, if it keeps getting electrocuted trying to get to the cheese, eventually it goes, maybe there's a way around this. Like, if you're doing the stand-up and you're not enjoying it, you're like, well, hang on, in this age of technology, I could do a podcast and reach an audience that actually, instead of five guys who are indifferent, it could be an audience of devoted people.
No, this is a result of lots of failure, years of failure, so it's a lesser failure. It's good. It's good.
No, but
I'm just kidding.
I've heard quite the opposite, to tell you.
But
this.
I mean, it's
hugely successful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that it is a great response to it.
So the last thing for our listeners, since a lot of them I know are like film students and film buffs and indie aspiring indie writers and stuff. All right, we talk about being proactive. I'll give you a for instance, like right now, just wrote this pilot. Everyone, like all the directors and stuff I know, they're all reading it and they're all loving it. What do you do? How do you even push it to the next step? How do you ask for that favor or don't ask for the favor? What is the secret ingredient to getting someone that loves your work to commit to doing it?
Ask for the favor.
You do?
Yeah.
You just ask straight up.
And you don't have to make apologies for it, because that's how, you know, you'd be, actually, back to Bob Shea. He has a great term called prudent aggression.
Yeah.
You have to be prudently aggressive about your work.
I mean, but do you have an agent representing it?
I used to, but no, not this project. I used to have one, and I don't have representation.
I think there's you know, a million different ways to skin a cat, so there's not one answer. But I think you can ask for the favor. You can also send it to agencies and go that more official route. But I think one thing technology has done, as we're discovering sitting in a restaurant doing a podcast, is that technology has democratized, I think, this creative process.
That's a really
it used to be a very exclusive club. When I went to film school to make a film, you had to shoot on film. 16 mil or 35 mil was prohibitively,
really
leave
expensive.
That word out, prohibitively expensive. Now, every nine-year-old kid has got
you
a
shoot
Canon
it with your iPhone,
camera.
Right. Or you could shoot it with your iPhone.
I think one great thing to do with it is if you really like the script and you believe in it,
shoot
if you
it
have
maybe.
Something, is, yeah, get some friends together that you think are super funny, get a crew together, shoot it on a Canon 5D camera. And actually, when you have something to show people, if you can walk into someone's office
isn't
and say, here's a pilot script
isn't
I wrote.
Isn't that
what
you did
with Saw? Going into someone's office and saying, here's a script is one thing. Going into someone's office and saying, here's a finished product, is completely different. I think people have a lot more time for finished products because a script is just another boring... It's a pile of white pages sitting on a pile. It's agents. They take a pile this high. For the people at home, I'm widening my hand as if it was a big pile. You know, they don't like it. If you give them a DVD or a, you know, something to watch it on, you can email them a link to something... You're taking up a shorter amount of their day. It's really dynamic, and they can see a finished product. If their imagination doesn't stretch that far, that's happening more and more. I mean,
no, that's
I think,
what we did with our pilot this year with Kate Walsh and Dermot Mulroney and all them as we filmed it, and then we did it on our own though. And then you could just show it to people.
Yeah,
right.
And absolutely. Then, that's what I believe. Workaholics, the show.
They did that
is
as
something
well.
They just
that's better than The Favor.
Yeah, is that better than The
yeah,
Favor?
Yeah, I think that this is actually a really exciting time for indie filmmakers and upcoming filmmakers because compared to when I went to film school, at least. It is, you can go out there and you can shoot a feature on a camera and it'll look beautiful.
Production.
It'll look as good as a 35mm film looks. And then you can edit it on a Mac that your friend has at his house and you can get, you know, your friend to score it because he has this equipment that he's bought with his computer. It's just an insane time for creativity. And so
James actually edited Insidious on his dining room table pretty
really?
Much. Yeah.
That's insanity. All right, Lynn Shay.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is awesome.
Thank you guys for coming by. I'm sorry for keeping
you
so long.
Let's do it again.
I'd love to do it again. You're great. This was actually...
I don't have
I actually have
to
go to a friend improv show. That's why I have to go. He's like, will you come and see
is that where you're going?
Show?
Yeah. What improv show? Where at?
It's at Tree People, which is this park in L.A. It's up on Mulholland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's where it's opposite where Franklin Canyon Park is. You know that
park? Do you know what the theme of the show is? Do
it's,
they have a theme?
It's for charity, and it's a bunch of it's a bunch of improv teams, including Shitty Jobs with Donald Glover, and like really good improv teams. And it's on tonight. So anyone who's listening to this,
Paul Scheer going to be there? Any UCB people?
I think there'll be a lot of UCB people.
Yeah,
there.
Probably right.
It's at the Mark Taper Amphitheater, which is an outdoor amphitheater at Tree People.
Tree People.
Tree People.
Google it.
Google it, ladies and gentlemen. Google it.
And then, of
can
course,
I do my Steve Buscemi impression?
Yes, well, you can.
You haven't said a fucking word this whole time. Oh, you said two words. That's a fun enough conversation, man. That's a fucking geyser. The two can play at that game, man. I'm not saying a fucking word. Total fucking silence.
That's like grown-up Steve Buscemi.
That's like Fargo
that's
Steve Buscemi.
That's
not a bad
Daddy.
Steve Buscemi. That is shameless.
That
coming
lounge.
On some guy's show who's lounge. Been nice enough to have you on his podcast and you're like wedge in this unrelated impression.
No, don't worry. I'm going to be, in our futures, I will be ridiculously shameless to you. So don't worry.
Okay, great, great.
Don't worry about it. I will be asking for favors and being proactive.
That's, there you
go. Fuck yourself, man. Okay. I don't tip, by the way.
Fuck myself.
I'm not fucking...
Okay.
Goddamn pizza.
Insidious 2, you can go see it Thursday night at midnight, right? They got the midnight.
And there's also
right.
a double feature.
The
double feature tomorrow at the ArcLight. There's a double feature tomorrow night.
Yeah, there is a double feature at the ArcLight Hollywood and the ArcLight Pasadena.
And do Insidious 2, right?
Back to back. So it's a back to back double feature.
And there's a Q&A, right?
Yep. The Q&A is before.
Big time. It's big time.
It's fucking big time.
Is Juan going to be there? Or is he totally just
he's Hollywood land, fam. Every time I call his phone right now, his assistant answers.
Today was his first day of shooting.
Oh, it's over for you guys. So, you guys used to
I will never hear from him again.
Good to know. Now you can call him Jimmy Juan, because they'll never get back to him. Jimmy Juan's kind of sounds like a schlong nickname, though, so I may have to change that. Jimmy Juan.
I think it should be Jimmy's Juan.
Jimmy's Juan. Yeah, he'll love that.
Yeah.
I am not going to be in any.
I may never be in one of his. I never be in any of his movies again after that.
Insidious 2 tomorrow night starts tomorrow night. ArcLight here in L.A. for the rest of you folks. Midnight, go see it, and then Friday it runs for weeks.
Runs big, yeah.
But it's a great, great horror movie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Lynn. And we hope to see you guys soon.
Yes, sir.
Great show. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another. The Phil Heath interview we are going to play probably when I get back, I think, is the deal, right? So you can check out Generation Iron, though, on September 18th. Oh, Insidious 2, tomorrow. Tomorrow night at the ArcLight with Insidious 1, and there'll be a Q&A. And then at midnight, you can go see it in your local theater. And I believe there's even going to be like 10 p.m. shows. 603 North Hollywood Way, Tay, Chicago, here in Burbank, California. MatthewAaronShow.com, all that crap. Oh, yeah. Twitter, Matt Aaron Show. I don't know. Whatever. Find us. All right. I will see you guys in 2 weeks. Thank you very much.